to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Art with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to State of the Arts. I'm Michael Sterling.
And I am Paul Strolley.
And
we are presented. Go ahead, Michael. Go ahead.
I don't know where I'm going.
Go ahead.
No. And we're presented by Breakdown Services.
Which, for those of you who don't know, Breakdown Services, our presenting sponsor, delighted to have them. All things actor-related available at Breakdown Services. Very exciting show today, Michael.
I know. Indeed, we do.
We did
have an exciting show. We have two wonderful guests in studio with us today, the lovely Suzanne Wong.
Yes.
From television, an actor, stand-up comedian, published author, minister, radio host, philanthropist, public speaker, dessert topping, and floor wax.
She sounds great.
She is. We also have Mr. Tim Dang, actor and producing artistic director of the distinguished East-West Players at the David Henry Wang Theater downtown Los Angeles, and he joins us in our second half hour, but he's here in studio and ready to roll with us during the first half hour. So we look forward to discussing East-West's 45th spectacular season under the guidance of Tim at the helm of the organization since 1993.
How are you, Tim?
I am fine. Thanks for having me.
Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you very much. You know, I thought that Tim, I had heard about him but never met him before, and I assumed that he was like 65 years old because of all the stuff that he's accomplished. No, seriously. And maybe you are, and yellow don't mellow, but you look great.
But you know, it's really amazing that everyone thinks that the Asian American acting community is so small, but it has grown so much by leaps and bounds that there are a lot of times where you don't know everyone that's in that community.
Yeah.
Right. I was astounded at just the amount of time that your theater has been. Is it 45th year?
45th year.
Unbelievable.
Can you believe that?
Unbelievable.
1965.
Stunning. Wow. Really stunning.
I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Absolutely.
How was your week, Michael?
You know, it was...
Was it magical? Your headset is falling off.
There you go. That's magical. It was, you know, the tail end of the moving. The thing we...
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Week.
Yes.
Moving in my home into, you know, a new location.
And congratulations.
Thank you.
Stressful,
thank you.
I'm sure.
Stressful, of course,
yes.
Because not only do we do this, I have a company that I run... And a nightclub that I produce, the best of Broadway performers and nightclub artists in concert.
I want to come to that.
Oh,
when
come.
Is the next one?
Yeah, we're there every weekend.
Just about every Sunday night?
Every Sunday
Sterling's
night.
Upstairs at Vitello's. You know Vitello's restaurant
yes.
in Studio
yes.
City?
That's yes. right across from Aroma
yeah,
Coffee and Tea, where I always go.
Yeah,
that's
Michael
right.
has the coolest little supper club up there. Yeah. It's like you're in New York City at a little supper club. It's a great little venue.
Yeah,
I performed there, actually.
Funny. Yes, he did.
Yeah, I did my all-nude water ballet there. Magical.
All nude, meaning you're all nude or everybody's all nude?
That was it, all nude. So it was sparsely attended, but it was...
Well, you know, speaking of all nude. Speaking of all nude.
It was all nude. There were only two of us, and I paid one of them. But it was all nude. That's the important thing.
Speaking of that.
Yes.
How was your week?
Speaking of nude, how was
yes,
my week?
How
like,
was
that's
your
how
week?
I spent my week. It was fine.
Body parts.
We have the foot issue in my family.
I understand.
I spoke to my sister earlier today. My sister is listening from Connecticut. Hello, Carrie. And
hello, Carrie.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Carrie.
She was at a casino seeing Stevie Nicks perform,
mm-hmm.
Who is 62 years old, by the way. Stevie
wow.
Nicks is still burning it down,
oh,
according
God.
To my
wow.
sister. Yeah.
Wow.
And she got hit on by a rather diminutive man in the casino.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister's attractive. It's expected that she would be. Happily, she's... Didn't you know? I don't look like my sister. She's the attractive one, but she got hit on by this guy, and she didn't really know what to do. It hasn't happened in a long time, and before she knew what to say, you know, because she's not in that. She's married. She's got two kids. She's not in that world anymore. Before she knew what was coming out of her mouth, the first thing she said was, "Your feet are so small."
Oh no!
This was her.
And you know
reaction.
What they say about small feet.
Well, exactly. And then the funniest part of the story for me is that she then said, "No. What are you, like a men's 9.5?" Now the fact that she
like she's a shoe salesman. Now?
But also the fact that she had to specify men's. Like his feet were so small he could have bought them in the Husky Boys department.
Oh, gosh.
Or maybe he's not yet even
yes.
a man.
And then she went over, and then she goes, and Paul, I didn't even realize she was doing this during this whole event. And then she took insult to injury by then going, no, wait, no. See, look at my foot. And then she holds her foot up next to his. And he just turned around and walked away. And I was like, Carrie, you know, a lot of women should know about this tactic to get people, you know, if people are bothering them. Mm-hmm. But it goes back to the whole thing of the feet in my family. I have big feet. I have size 15.
Does she have big feet?
She has larger feet for a woman, but she's not like
What
me.
Is a large size foot for a woman?
What would you say, 11?
Sure. I wear a 6, so 11 is quite large.
So anything over
You're
6 is
You're tall for a 6, though.
I am?
Yeah. I mean, because my wife is a 6, and my wife is 5 feet.
Huh.
So, but I mean, isn't that a small foot for a tall woman?
Yeah, I think 6 is pretty...
But all logic is out the window, because I wear size 15, and I'm 6'2", and
what
my brother...
What does Shaq wear? I mean, 15, that's huge.
Michael, well, Michael made the same comment.
I said, with a tone like I
should be seated next to the bearded lady and next to the human salamander.
Because 15 is huge. And by the way, you guys can't see this, unfortunately, for you, but... His hands, Paul's hands are gigantic. They make a basketball look like a baseball in your hand.
I have hands like a tree frog. That's how I
do
myself.
You do.
I do have
NBA. So there's got to be something redeeming about the size of your feet.
Do you play keyboard or do you? Yeah, there's got to be something.
I juggle.
I
juggle.
You do.
I can do an octave and a fifth on a keyboard. I can do 13 keys.
You juggle bowling balls or what do you juggle?
Wow,
she's not speaking in euphemisms, ladies and gentlemen. We're here all week. No, I don't play the instruments that I should play, just to have more innuendo there. But I don't...
Speaking of innuendo, are you going to tell us if it's true what they say?
Yeah, please.
No, let's move on. Let's move on.
Let's not, let's keep Paul. It all. There's a lot of people out there listening. Fascinated.
Kind of show.
You
know
because,
what?
Paul, you brought it up.
Okay, no, here's what I brought up. This is the story, and I got to get to it because we want to get to the rest of the show. But... The thing with my foot is I was backstage doing a show called Wonder of the World with a woman named Jen Ray, and she was dressed as a clown at the end of the show. We're about to go out for a curtain call. And we're standing next to one another when both of us realize that she's wearing clown shoes, and my natural feet are larger than her feet in the clown shoes, which means that my feet are larger than what the clown industry dictates as comically large.
As a ridiculously large foot.
Exactly. So enough about my feet. Let's talk to Suzanne about her feet.
Suzanne.
Okay.
Her size, six
you
want to
talk
feet.
About my feet, though? Actually, here's the thing. I've been in this business for 20 years, and I've gotten a lot of fan mail from different people. And for some reason, I seem to attract men with foot fetishes, and I am not kidding you. I get email and fan letters from guys saying, I love your feet. I did an episode of Fox After Breakfast, the show I used to host with Tom Bergeron out of New York City, and I traveled the country. And anyway, I did one episode where I'm in a bathing suit, and it was about dog safety in swimming pools, and I didn't have shoes on by the pool. And this guy says, you have gorgeous feet. May I have a picture? Can you take a photo of just your feet and send it to me? And I'm thinking, no. and then I've gotten emails saying, can you send me a high-heeled shoe that you have worn?
Yeah.
Because they're going to sniff it or laminate the inside of it. It's just so horrifying
Whenever you're given a request to photograph a section of your body and submit
right.
it. Whenever
really
it's
think,
isolated like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sign me up,
you know,
for that.
Yeah, you're jumping off the edge of the weirdo pool. But I'm curious because you said you talked about your hosting duties, and we spoke before the show, Suzanne. I was talking about how much my wife and I liked House Hunters, and
Thank you. We saw
your stand-up. And I'm always curious about because you do so much, because you wear so many hats, what was first in the process? Were you an actor first?
Sure.
Were you a stand-up first? Your hosting duties?
I started as an actor 20 years ago in Boston.
When you were 5.
When I was 5. Oh, yes. I love you. I'll send you a check.
Okay. With a picture of your feet, please.
A laminated picture of my feet.
Yes, please. But only if you've worn the shoe.
Started as an actor 20 years ago in Boston. Became a television host 12 years ago in New York City. My first job was on FX, a show called Breakfast Time, which was the cable version of Fox After Breakfast with Tom Bergeron. And I got to travel the country doing different live human interest segments. It was great. I've been to every state in the U.S.
Really?
Terrific.
I mean, that's, you know, incredible. I got to go see the country and do live human interest segments on a morning show with Tom Bergeron, and it was so much fun, and I've been friends with him for
Is he as genuinely nice as he seems?
I've been friends with him from Boston, from before we worked together in New York, and he's one of the most incredible, down-to-earth, smart, funny, genuine people.
He is.
Have you met him? Yeah, you know.
I have met him,
you know.
I always think when I see him on Dancing with the Stars that I wish they would let him go and not script him
Of course, because when you got to see him on FX and Fox, when they really let him go, you saw his pure genius. But, you know, I feel the same way on House Hunters, where they really didn't want me to be funny. It's like you have to fit into the box and do
the
what
corporate,
they want you to
the
do.
Corporate
yeah.
decision.
And
yeah,
I understand that. But then I became a TV host, and then that was about 12 years ago. And then about 8 years ago, I became a stand-up comedian. And then the author, public speaker, minister, all that stuff is pretty new.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to talk about the stand-up, if I could. I was delighted to see that you won the first annual Andy Kaufman Award at the New York Comedy Festival, because Andy Kaufman is just truly...
That was a thrill for me.
Iconic.
Yeah. And, you know, every time I would do my stand-up comedy act, which is character-driven, someone would come up to me after the performance and say... It's like Andy Kaufman's back from the dead. He would be so happy right now. And so when I found out there was an Andy Kaufman award competition, I thought, well, I have to submit my material.
Well, so. And I noticed that when I watched you, because I saw Sung-hee Park. She has this alter ego that she opens the show. Is a show usually split like that, where you have the first half?
Yes, I start with Sung-hee Park, which is this character that I developed in acting class at the Beverly Hills Playhouse, right. Which was sort of a solution to my... My teacher felt that I had a huge judgment about the stereotype of Asian women, to the point where I was violently trying to prove to everyone that I'm nothing like that and it has nothing to do with me. And he said, what would happen if you embraced that stereotypical Asian woman that you hate so much and see what happens? And I remember thinking... I thought he was a great teacher. Now he's a jerk. And I was thinking, I'm going to quit class, and that's a terrible idea, and why would I do that? And he said, you're spending so much energy resisting the stereotype in any way and denying the fact that you're Asian in any way that you're still at the effect of it. What would happen if you just embraced it as part of your artistic palette? And that's all he said. And so I went home that night furious and convinced that I was going to quit class. But then I thought, no, you know, he's thrown down the gauntlet. I'm paying for class. I might as well... fully try what he's saying, mm-hmm, and then decide whether I'm going to leave class. Because it'd be crazy to go to a doctor and then not do what the doctor recommends. Go to a teacher, not do something the teacher suggests. So the next morning, I was thinking, okay, I don't want to do this. I was livid, but I'm going to try it. So because I didn't want to do this, I was having like an organ reject with this assignment. Like, you know, I was like, ugh, get out of me. So it didn't want to happen from the inside out. So I thought I'd do what the British actors do, and they work from the outside in often. If they get the right hat. Right. You know this, Tim. You know, you get the right pair of shoes or the right cane or something, it informs you.
Sure.
So I went to Koreatown the next day, and I decided to buy a hanbok, which is a traditional Korean full-length dress. Mm-hmm. And I bought a Korean fan and the Korean shoes, and I just bought the whole outfit, and I put it on at my house. And I just stood there hoping that it would inform me in some way. And I was still livid. And I'm not very patient, but I was patient enough to wait for some idea. And I got the idea... Wait a minute, what if she were a stand-up comedian? What if she just got here from Seoul, South Korea? What if she's terrible at it? What if she doesn't know what she's doing? What if English is not her first language? What if she's so nervous, it's so important to her to come to Hollywood and make it as a comedian, that she will commit suicide, she will cry on stage if it doesn't go well?
Right.
And then what if she unwittingly is telling horrific racist and off-color and vulgar and blue jokes, but she doesn't know it?
Right.
And then I started to get excited about creating a satire. It's sort of like, the reason people compare it to Andy Kaufman is because it would be like if Latka on Taxi tried to get up and do stand-up, and he just doesn't know what he's doing and what's going on, and that's where the humor comes from, the discomfort of the culture shock and him not understanding how to tell a joke. And that's how it developed, and it became this sensation, and it's very controversial, and people either love it or hate it. They get it, they don't get it. But I embrace that. I used to be the kind of person who... you know, didn't want to make waves and wanted to please everybody and run for mayor, and that doesn't make for a good artist.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So.
Well, I would say that it's similar to Kaufman in another way too. That is trusting the silences. Is that so much of the time, especially with stand-up now, it's so assaultive with words. It's just like, bam, it's just, and everywhere we look, and especially in Los Angeles, you're just assaulted with words everywhere you look. And what I appreciated about it was the trusting the silence is giving the audience a little credit to sort of get it. And it is, I mean, what's interesting about it, Michael, you should see it, Tim, you should, everyone should see it, but it's, she does do these incredibly racist, politically incorrect jokes, but it's this indictment of racism. I mean, it really, it comments on racism through, you know, and I love the metaphor of All in the Family. It's very similar to that.
Yes.
But very, very funny, and I really did enjoy it. And does she have, now you have a promotional piece on your website, a DVD. Is it just her, or
it's
is
just,
it both?
It's just her, okay. But I'm working on, I just did a show that I did a half an hour as Sung Hee Park and an hour as myself, so I'm putting that onto a DVD so I can get that out there too, because I do stand up as myself as well. And I have a couple of shows coming up that I want to tell you about.
Oh, please do. Please
one,
do. Yes.
One is on September 25th. It's Comedy Unleashed, Stand Up for Gay Youth. I'm a huge gay marriage rights activist, and it sort of happened a little bit, by falling into it, because people are like, you're a straight Asian female, why do you care about gay rights? And I'm thinking, yes, but I've experienced racism and sexism my whole life. And to me, gay rights is the last stand of civil rights in this country. I know what it feels like to be discriminated against and disenfranchised and all of that. So, and there's this great quote by Nelson Henderson where he says, "We must continue to plant trees under whose shade we never planned to enjoy."
Oh, that is a great quote.
And that's how I think of it. You know, it's like it doesn't benefit me directly, but it benefits the planet. And so I debated Prop 8 on television, and I speak at gay rights rallies and all of that, and I'm really fired up about it. Anyway, plus I go to Provincetown every summer usually, and I do stand-up, and there's nothing like doing my stand-up comedy act for 350 gay men. They go crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, there were when I saw the performance...
You do not know what it's like to be loved until a room full of gay men decide that they love you.
There were a number of card-carrying members of the Lavender Elite at the show that that I was at, and they were digging
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so this is a benefit for the Jeff Griffith Center at the Avalon Theater in Hollywood. It's going to be a great lineup of comedians. It's Saturday, September 25th at 7 p.m. And you can go to gayforpaycomedy.com.
Wow. Be very careful about typing that website in.
And then on September 26th, I'm doing something called the Cosmic Comedy Salon. I'm also a minister and a guest speaker at spiritual centers, and I combine my spiritual metaphysical path with humor. And that's going to be on September 26th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. And that website is heavenonearthla.com. So I've been having a lot of fun doing stand-up.
Outstanding.
Lately.
You know, Paul, earlier today, we always meet before the show. We kind of run it down. And he was giving me some lines about that character that you told me that you developed.
Yes.
Hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
And I brought up, I said, do you know Lisa Lampanelli? Which he does.
Right.
And I love Lisa Lampanelli. Do you know her?
Mm-hmm.
Do you like her, Tim?
Mm-hmm.
She's hilarious.
Yeah. She's got a show. I mean, I think she's got her own show coming out. I remember, I think we listed it at a breakdown or
a series?
Russian Reference Service, that she has her own series. Yeah. You can sort of see her trajectory through the roasts, through the Comedy Central roast.
Yeah.
That she's really sort of defined, you know, who she is. It's one of the reasons, the roast especially, and touching on this again before we wrap it up with Suzanne, is the political correctness factor. And mm-hmm. Lisa Lampanelli is about as far from politically correct as I've seen in a long time, as Suzanne is. And I truly think, especially the show that we're working on now, my theater company is doing a spoof of John Steinbeck called Of Grapes and Nuts. It's a very, very funny parody of John Steinbeck.
So Grapes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men, and it's Of Grapes and Nuts.
Of Grapes and Nuts. It is stupid funny. We open September 18th.
That's right.
But and it is
about
as far from politically correct as possible. And I you know, you mentioned your causes, and my cause is that I am political correctness is killing comedy. And there is just no, everyone is so apprehensive about offending people. And if ever there was a time that we needed to, I mean, Of Grapes and Nuts pokes fun at Steinbeck. So in effect, you're poking fun at Americana by poking fun at John Steinbeck. But we just so need that right now.
Well, for me, the political correctness is so damaging for us to just, smile and be polite and put a plastic face over it and act like everything's okay. And I realize that there are many different ways to approach a topic, but... You know, I believe we give words power by banning them. We, whatever you resist persists. Whatever you like, whatever you ban becomes that much more important that people, it just seems to empower it. Like, I really believe that, you know, this country's obsession with females' breasts, if everybody just started walking, all women just started walking around topless all the time, at first it would be probably crazy, madness, right? But eventually you would just habituate to it and become desensitized, like they do in other countries where it isn't such a big deal to see a breast.
Look at alcohol. You know what I mean? Look at alcohol consumption in other countries. In all the cultures where it is not denied young people, it's not an issue when you turn 21. You don't immediately have to get hammered if you've been, like, my family was Italian and is Italian. It's not like we converted. But, you go over there and there's wine at the table and there'll be a 10-year-old having wine with their dinner and it doesn't affect anything. They're not getting hammered. It's just part of the culture, you know.
Right.
And just exactly that. Yes. And I personally would vote for a topless universe. I would be all over that. I think that's an important thing. Matter of fact, I think we should start by putting photos on our website. What do you think?
There you go.
Get some traffic there.
And who better to start
Michael,
with?
Would you go topless for the website?
I would,
but I'm Italian. And as you know, as we discussed in an earlier show, you know, putting sunblock on me is like trying to get peanut butter out of a shag carpet.
The men would have to go bottomless, though, in fairness. And what I loved about forgetting Sarah Marshall is that Jason Segel is fully frontally nude about five different times in that movie.
Yeah.
And that never happens because there's this double standard that women should show their breasts, but men shouldn't have to show their penises. And it's like, you know, come on, why not?
Well, let's face why not. One is a hell of a lot prettier than the other.
Depends on your perspective. But I mean, we are so repressed about sex in this country because of religion and a number of other reasons.
Right.
That's why I used to host on Playboy Radio and talk about sex and sexuality and topics in the news and fetishes and sex crimes. And I feel like one of the reasons it's so rampant is because of this incredible repression. Sex is bad. Sex is evil. Sex is wrong. Don't do it ever. Don't enjoy it unless, you know what I mean? And so all people want to do is get out there and find the craziest way to do it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You
and
know?
Then that's it. That whole repression thing just, you know, when the valve breaks, it breaks in some weird predilection. It's just sort of like, you know, they can't just have sex now. There has to be, you know, a donkey, a dwarf, and a bale of hay involved.
And you're a comedian. You know the value of comedy. To me, when we're laughing, we're in the present moment. I think it breaks down people's defenses. It helps put us all on a level playing field. And if you have a message at all, it helps you sneak it in as opposed to standing on a soapbox,
wagging
your finger
covertly
at people. And that's how people end up getting defensive, is when you're standing scolding or preaching to them.
An accusatory tone.
Yeah, exactly.
So let me ask you something now, Suzanne. You have this amazing side of you as an actress and as a comedian, and you also have another side of you, which is as an author.
Yes.
And from your experience on television with House Hunters, you've written
this book. Yeah, I wrote a book called Suzanne Huang's Guide to Happy Home Buying.
And it's currently in stores everywhere and available on Amazon.com.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the book.
You know,
it's a lighthearted
thing
kind of thing, right?
I co-wrote it. You know, it's so funny. When you write a book and people say, oh, we'll get you a ghost author. Because I'm thinking, wait, I can't write a book about house hunting. I'm a TV host. I'm not a real estate agent. I'm not an expert. And they say, we get you an expert who writes the factual part, and then you fill in your experiences, your sense of humor, your point of view, your spiritual tactic on how to manifest your dream come true kind of stuff. But I said, no, he's going to be credited, because I find it really odd when you find out that an autobiography of a famous person wasn't actually written by them.
In
you
the
know
same
what I
way.
Mean? So I just wanted him to have credit. But basically it was written in 2006, though, and now it's 2010. So, you know, as far as the factual information, that changes all the time. But and it started me with a whole path of writing that I'm really enjoying. I'm doing spoken word and storytelling events, and I'm now doing professional keynote speaking, inspirational speaking. I was the one responsible for getting Oprah to do a show about The Secret. And so,
as I see, yes.
Yeah, I have a whole spiritual side to me that people are usually shocked about. Every single thing I do, I'm on House Hunters as the girl next door, and then they come see my stand-up comedy, and they go, oh my God, what happened to our dear sweet Suzanne? Oh my God. Because it's really edgy and filthy and, you know.
Well, I got to say, too, we only have 2 minutes left, but I want to say that, speaking of House Hunters, what's the deal with taking the host off House Hunters?
I know.
Why the voiceover?
Don't these people realize that the host is the face of the show?
They don't.
You know what we should do is start a Twitter
campaign.
Start a campaign. A Facebook campaign.
See, because I want a campaign that Suzanne's feet host Outsiders. We only see her feet.
Only my feet.
Yes.
Then everyone will be happy.
Talking toes. We'll address all the sexual deviance
and
special voiceover
your,
with just her
hands.
Feet. Yes.
Well,
yes.
In fairness, you know, people always assume when you're not on a show anymore that you got fired. In fairness, I chose to go after almost a decade of hosting the show. So when people get up in arms saying, I can't believe they fired you, and I say, no, they didn't fire me. I decided it was time to go. They made an offer to me, and I chose not to accept it, you know,
right.
after almost 10 years. But even having said that, though, people are still upset that there's no host at all. Now they just go to voiceovers because I guess there's a mentality at the network that the hosts of the show aren't important to the shows. And I'm thinking, really?
Well, look,
that's
at
what you think?
Trading Spaces. They did that with Paige,
I
whatever.
I know,
and
she just, was a huge part of that show.
She was a huge part
yes.
of the show. It's,
yes.
I mean, it's throwing a party with no host. It's like
right.
throwing a bunch of people in a room and going, here, have a cocktail and just create your own conversation. Have no one
talk amongst
the
yourselves.
But
goodbye.
The good news is that they're still showing my reruns and probably will until the end of time.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, there's House Hunters and House Hunters International. And people
exactly.
who love it, and they get to see it, and they're addicted to it. And
right.
they confess to me that they're addicted
and
to it.
And it's so interesting watching you on the reruns, which I do now, because I told Suzanne earlier that the only channel I get at the house since I've moved into the new house
is HGTV.
Is HGTV. No, wow. I just don't know how to work the new system, right?
Time Do you need Warner. An Asian to come over and help
I
you
do.
With your
do you
technology?
Know yeah.
I just have this image of you, Michael, sitting
yeah.
on a milk crate, just watching
yeah.
like Glenn Close and, you know, turning the light on and
That's
off.
That's what I do. That's what I do. And
an obscure reference, but not
was
wasted
that
on this.
Attraction?
Yes, yes.
I got it.
And I
yeah.
couldn't think of the title of the film.
And
on
it's
the
quite something to see her walking through gardens with her hands clasped, you know.
Why?
Doing her opening.
Oh, just the look?
Yeah, the look.
Because
yeah,
I look, I'm wearing a cardigan sweater and I look very sweet
yeah,
and
no,
nice.
She's,
yeah. And then
she,
I think of the.
And she's a very beautiful
park
woman
line
to begin just, with.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, 2006 People Magazine, one of the top.
I know,
that was
top.
Out of the blue.
Wow. There you go.
I know.
Wow. Suzanne, can you
Will
stay
you
with
chat?
Us?
Are
of
you?
Course.
Okay, so she's
going
to stay. We're going to do our. We have to do our arts calendar here, which I will kick off, and then we will speak to Tim Dang immediately following. Thank
Yay.
You, Tim, for being with us.
Sure.
Operas, dashing leading man and superb tenor, Charles Castronovo. You always do this to me, Sterling. You give me the weird names. Returns to Los Angeles September 25th at Colburn School Zipper Hall to say thank you to Opera Buffs, the organization that first recognized his talent 15 years ago. This very special appearance by Castronovo benefits Opera Buffs' mission of providing funding and performance opportunities for young artists in Southern California. Today, Castronovo is one of the most renowned singers of his generation, performing around the world at such venues as the New York Metropolitan Opera, the Opera Nationale de Paris.
De Paris.
Thank you. Can't you tell by this outrageous accent?
You show me your hand, I can tell.
Not for free, sailor. This month and next, he stars opposite Placido Domingo for the LA Opera and their world premiere of Il Postino, based on the motion picture of the same name.
Love it.
Yeah, I didn't know there was an opera about it.
Now's your chance to be a part of a rare, intimate, and razzle-dazzle evening with the incomparable Mitzi Gaynor at the Welk Resorts Theater in Escondido, California, September 2nd through September 5th. Now, here's a bit of trivia for you.
What?
Who, with 17 films to her credit, became one of the top singing and dancing motion picture stars of all time? Who conquered television with 9 show-stopping spectaculars garnering 17 Emmy nominations and blockbuster ratings? Whose dazzling triple threat talents made her arguably the top female nightclub and concert attraction of the era?
Pia Zadora.
I'm going to say Mitzi Gaynor. Is it Mitzi Gaynor?
It would be Mitzi Gaynor. We're absolutely
holding
right, Suzanne.
Holding the paper up.
And ladies and gentlemen.
That's not why. It's because he was just talking about Mitzi Gaynor. Isn't she from
go.
South Pacific? Is it the
yes,
same Mitzi
Yes, the same
Gaynor?
Mitzi Gaynor. Yeah.
How
and
old
you know
is
what?
She now?
She's in her 70s, and she
and
looks
she's fantastic?
Phenomenal.
Oh, my
yeah.
God.
Phenomenal.
She
I
was at the
that.
Opening. We saw her at the... you weren't there that night, but
yes,
the night I was
the,
at South Pacific, she was there.
For, at the Amazon.
She looks fantastic.
We reviewed
yeah.
The show.
Nice feet, too.
Oh,
so, don't miss her.
I've created a monster.
Don't miss her in Razzle Dazzle, My Life Behind the Sequins.
Green Day's American Idiot continues to pack him in for 8 performances a week at the the St. James Theater on Broadway. The show tells the exhilarating story of a new generation of young Americans as they struggle to find meaning in a post-9/11 world, borne along by Green Day's electrifying score. With an 8-member onstage band and a cast of 19, led by Tony Award winner John Gallagher Jr., this high-octane musical includes every song from the acclaimed album American Idiot, as well as several songs from the band's Grammy Award-winning new release, 21st Century Breakdown.
Steve Silver's Beach Blanket Babylon, the longest-running musical review in theater history, is a zany musical spoof of pop culture with extravagant costumes and outrageously huge hats. With sold-out performances since 1974, Beach Blanket Babylon is an internationally acclaimed San Francisco institution with more than 12,000 performances in San Francisco. The show has performed for standing room only during its London and Las Vegas engagements. Beach Blanket Babylon continually evolves in its hilarious parodies of current events and popular icons as today's headlines unfold. Offering 7 performances a week, don't miss this San Francisco treat at Club Fugazi in the heart of San Francisco's North Beach District.
For further information about any productions and or events mentioned on today's State of the Arts live calendar, visit us during the week ahead at stateoftheartsla.com. That's stateoftheartsla.com. And I just want to say, too, for those of you that don't believe that my feet are actually larger than clown shoes, I'm going to post the picture of that comparison on the website so you can actually see.
Can you post your hands?
How freakish.
She's hung up on the hands. Bro.
I am hung up on the hands.
Actually, you can go to, you can call 976-HOT-WOP for that.
You said it, not me.
I'm Italian.
Listen, one more thing about Performing Arts Live, because we love them. They're a new sponsor that is ongoing for us. And when you have a moment, ladies and gentlemen, go to their website, performingartslive.com, and you can search for Southern California events in several different categories any day of the week. But now, Paul, we're going to move on to our next guest, who's been such a gentleman, sitting here listening to us being silly.
Yeah.
And he is...
And Suzanne's been all over him. You can't tell when she's talking, because, yes. But
what do you mean, all over, like I've been humping him? What are you talking about?
Tim Dang.
I am just in awe of Suzanne.
Are you?
She is so entrepreneurial, and she has, all these different careers.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Amazing. She's not got no free time.
What are you doing time. Your free time? Yeah, exactly.
I nap.
Oh,
we all try, don't we? Let me give you the proper intro. Tim Dang, actor and producing artistic director for the distinguished East-West Players at the David Henry Hwang Theater, downtown Los Angeles.
Now, that's a Wong.
That's a Wong.
It is. He's just like me, David Henry Hwang.
Oh, okay. Oh, there you go. My mistake.
but he's Tim Dang.
He's Tim Dang.
That's but right. It's Hwang.
Dang Hwang.
And Suzanne Hwang. Yeah.
There we
this
go.
Is not confusing for us
it is
Caucasians.
Very confusing.
So yeah. Let me just say that again. East-West Players at the David Henry Hwang Theater.
Yeah.
Downtown
perfect.
Los Angeles joins us. We look forward to discussing, Tim, your organization's spectacular 45th season.
Unbelievable.
That you have been guiding them through since 1993.
Since 1993, right. Mako was the original or the founding artistic director, and then Nobu McCarthy took over in the late 80s, and I took over in 93.
Wow. And it's such a beautiful experience to go downtown Los Angeles. I always like to go to his theater on a Sunday afternoon when there's minimal traffic downtown L.A.
It's
on the
beautiful.
Street.
Yeah.
There's a serenity that goes on down there. And I've seen some fabulous shows. I told you that. I've seen Follies. I've seen your production of Pippin, which was quite
Pippin.
Extraordinary. And actually, tell me if this is true or not, but the original composer of the show was so taken with that that he said, I heard that he said to you, now, when it was going to go to the open at the Music Center in Los Angeles,
right.
that he said that he was going to take some of your ideas.
Stephen Schwartz actually attended opening night.
Yes,
of
really.
Pippin. And what we did to it is that
it was
we
brilliant,
had
this
turned
idea.
It into a hip hop anime musical.
So cool.
So with Bob Fosse's dance choreography with isolation and this hip movement. That we thought that we could actually translate that into hip hop, and it actually worked really, really well.
Were you in it?
I was not in it. I directed it.
Do you do hip hop dancing?
I don't. We actually had Jason Tyler Chong, who's a up and coming choreographer, do the choreography along with Blythe Matsui, and they did a great bang up job of doing it. And I think Stephen was pleasantly surprised, and yes, he was going to steal some ideas.
Did he?
And I believe he did. And at that time, he was also working on a revival of Godspell.
Yes.
And so he was. There were those ideas that.
Was it a collective decision to make it anime? Was it your decision as a director to just sort of apply that architecture to it? Or how did that idea? Because it's a fantastic idea. And as soon as you say it, it makes perfect sense for that show.
Well, you know, anime is really big in the Asian community.
Oh, yeah.
And so you haven't seen it that much in theater yet. And I think by applying it to theater, that it could be a really great structure for a new or melding art form.
But how was it applied, though? I'm interested because anime is just that. I mean, it's animation. Mm-hmm. So was it just the style of the costumes to reflect that sort of look and that real...
Right. So you take what is called cosplay or costume play, and we actually went one step further with that. We added a background, a moving background to the show. Mm-hmm. So when the characters were walking, the background was moving as if they were like walking through a garden or something.
Right, right.
And so it worked really well. We added a DJ to the band.
To the band, yeah.
And so they were scratching the records while all the music was happening.
It was brilliant, really. So,
did you see it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh. An extraordinary cast. Marcus Choi and Ethan LaFong.
Right.
Interesting story, I think, about Ethan, because he came into the show literally, what, on 48 hours notice or something?
Right.
And took over the lead.
Right, right, right.
You had a problem or something happened with whoever was playing the lead before.
Right. Ethan was actually originally cast as the understudy, and he was doing another show at the Pasadena Playhouse, which is why we had cast him.
He's doing Mask, I think, there.
That's right.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, what a great memory you have.
You are incredible.
Oh my God,
he doesn't get any channels. He's got nothing else to do.
I remember I got to see The Tempest, and wasn't Daniel Day Kim
in
The Tempest?
Yes.
And you know, he went on to become very famous on Lost.
And now Hawaii Five-0. That's
I did not know that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Starts soon.
He's great. And you were saying before we started that it's the oldest theater of color.
Right.
Is that true?
It's the oldest theater of color in the country, and it is now probably the largest Asian American performing arts producing entity.
Rock on, Tim. So. Yellow power in the house.
Finish the little story about Ethan.
No. So what had happened is that there was a problem with the person playing the role of Pippin, and so we had to make a cast change, and
which happens,
which happens, and lo and behold, we had Ethan going on book for the first and second preview. And by the time the third preview came around, just like a trooper, just like that Shirley MacLaine story, I mean, he took that lead role and just ran with it.
And he did. He did indeed.
I'm sorry, I don't know the Shirley MacLaine story.
Oh, Shirley MacLaine got all of her recognition because she went in as an understudy.
Was it for Sweet Charity?
Yeah.
She was an understudy?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
That's true. I'm surprised that I know that. not a story I would normally know.
I don't think it was Sweet Charity, though.
What? I don't know.
Sure. I think it was Pajama Game, was it?
Was it?
Oh, gosh.
I thought she became famous because of Sweet Charity.
Well, the movie.
No.
She did the movie.
Oh, she didn't do the play?
No, Gwen Verdon did the musical.
Well, see, this is good. You'll be getting
emails. Don't you have Google now? Let's look it up.
Yeah. I can't touch any of the equipment.
but we digress. We digress. So, of course, I saw Pippin, and... Loved that, which brought me back to see the stage version of one of my all-time favorite movies, The Joy Luck Club.
Oh, yeah.
How beautiful was
that? By Susan Kim, yes.
Yes, exactly.
It was great. John Lawrence Rivera, one of the top directors in Los Angeles.
Was it adapted from the film, or did the play already exist? And then
it was actually based on the book. Amy Tan.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So, but it was independent of the film,
of
the play. Okay.
Right.
It was a great book.
So I've never seen anything that I didn't like.
And I want to know about
very kind of you.
I want to know what's come. Can you tell us a little about Mysterious Skin?
Because Mysterious Skin.
Absolutely. Mysterious Skin is actually based on the critically acclaimed novel by Scott Heim, and it was actually a play before it became a movie that starred Joseph Gordon-Levitt and was directed by Greg Araki back in 2006.
Yeah. Joseph Gordon, the Third Rock kid,
from
right?
Third Rock
yes.
in the Sun.
Okay.
Right,
okay.
Right. He had starred in it, and the great story about it is that it's about a teenager who believes that he has been abducted by aliens. And he meets up with this gay teenage hustler, and they unravel the mystery of mysterious skin. And it's actually pretty, you know, a pretty disturbing story, because it ends up that both of them were actually abused, sexually abused as children by their little league coach.
Ooh, wow.
And, you know, that's it turns pretty heavy. It's really cutting edge, very hip, edgy. Yeah. You know, just lots of
and risk and risk taking.
Wow. Yeah. How was the movie? Did you see the
movie?
It was
great.
Version, was it?
It was great. Greg Araki is a really great director. And one of the reasons why we decided to open it is because we had heard, from the Los Angeles Times, there was this article by Charles McNulty saying that because of the economic downturn, no one's taking risks, and our art is becoming very bland. And so this was one of the reasons. Michael Kaiser, who's the president of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, we have been involved in a partnership with him that he is working with capacity building for small and mid-sized arts organizations. He's saying that, you know, when you contract like this and become very conservative, one of the things that you need to do to break out of the box is get excited about a certain project, right, and bring attention to the organization, and you brand it that way as an organization that is taking risks at a time when everyone else is contracting. And so this is kind of the answer to what we're doing by starting with Mysterious Skin.
Wow. So now that opens your season. Then what else do you have in store after that?
Well, we're actually doing an Asian American version of the Pulitzer Prize winning play by Beth Henley called Crimes of the Heart.
Crimes of the Heart.
And so, yes. It's really funny. I don't know whether Suzanne would agree with me, but you know, I really think that Asian culture and Southern culture are like almost the same.
Oh, I would say that about Asian culture and Jewish culture. So tell me about what is it about Asians in the South?
I don't know. There's almost like there's just as much said with what isn't being said.
With no words, as it was, And food is the hub of everything.
Yes.
That's true in Jewish culture, too.
Yes.
Absolutely.
But, you know,
I
know what you mean, though, because in the South, they can say, bless your heart. And what they mean is, you know, go F yourself. Yeah.
It's all inflection. We talked earlier about trusting the silences. I think that's a perfect example of that.
Right, that's exactly
right. I can see that similarity, though. But also, could it be, too, the fact that sort of the... With Southern U.S., it's genteel, but with the, and I hope it's not racist to say, but the Asian sort of, the very reserved sort of quiet mentality that certain things aren't spoken.
Everything
the Southern gentility is the
sake.
Same, is very similar in that regard.
Right. In Asian culture, it's considered very low class to air your dirty laundry in front of people. You know, so there is that thing of like, oh no, everything's fine.
Yeah, and with the Italians, if we couldn't talk about dirty laundry, we'd have nothing to talk about.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's just too
well. And I am from South Korea.
That's why she has that accent.
Exactly.
What would that be, though? What would that be? I'm trying to think of a funny food metaphor for, but I don't know Korean cuisine, so I can't even do like a fried chicken something because I can't even think of it. You see, I can't deceive people. If I fail on a joke, I have to say something about it. So I want to tell people, too, about the opening night of Mysterious Skin, because I always like to alert people to these things, because our theater company tries to do event theater where there's a little more than the show offered, because I think that's important now where people are being very selective about their theater choices. So opening night for Mysterious Skin will be accompanied by a pre-performance cocktail reception and a post-show reception with the cast and creative team, which I always love because you get to see little behind. I always refer to that as like DVD, live DVD extras. Performances are Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 and Sundays at 2. Previews are Thursday through Saturday, September 9th through 11th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, September 12th at 2 p.m. You're also offering a pay what you can performance.
Which is such a great idea.
Yeah,
I think it's a brilliant idea.
It's a Thursday, September 16th. And in fact, following that performance, the author of the book, Scott Heim, he's actually flying in for the opening. That we're going to have a Q&A after that Thursday performance of the paper.
Cool. Oh, good. That's wonderful. Yeah, well, that was one of the biggest, very popular thing when I did my show in New York, was doing a little Q&A afterwards. And just, you know, it's just a little, you really have to, and you know, in this economic climate, you really have to think of these little perks and these little bits of what I call theatrical gravy that just sort of make it add to the meal a little bit and offer a little something else.
Well, the show opens September 15th, and it closes on Sunday, October 10th, Paul. And for tickets, one can purchase or find out more information by calling East West Players at 213-625-7000 or visiting East West Players at their website, eastwestplayers.org.
And I also want to go back to something, because one of the things that we do on the show that we haven't had the opportunity to do, because we went right into, I got caught up on my feet and talked about my feet too much, which is an easy thing to get caught up on, but size 15.
We initiate you
by sharing your nightmare theatrical story, and like the most either embarrassing thing to you happen, either on stage or while filming or on the set or whatever. And I don't know if you can pull them up readily, but do you have
only one?
What?
Sure. Let's see.
Got a nice juicy one for us.
I once did stand-up comedy, because the most tragic things happen if you're talking about stand-up comedy. Mm. I mean, think about it, because you're just on the precipice. What other art form is there where you know immediately and constantly whether it is going well or not? If you're on stage doing a drama, you have no idea if the people are enjoying it or not.
Exactly.
But when you're doing stand-up, you know. And if you're doing improv comedy, at least the responsibility is split amongst everybody on stage. When it's just you on stage, you know, you're on the precipice. So once I did stand-up comedy at Barfly. It's a nightclub. I can't even remember if it's in Hollywood. But instead of it being a place dedicated for stand-up comedy, it was a nightclub. And they took some curtains. It's a really high-ceiling nightclub. They took some curtains and just sectioned off an area of the nightclub on a Saturday night with curtains, and then put a microphone and a spotlight so that stand-up comedy is going on while there's loud people drunk and screaming and dancing and music going on everywhere else in the nightclub.
Because we all know how a curtain just stops sound.
A curtain just stops sound completely, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I get on stage, and I'm doing my Sung-hee Park character, which is very visual. I'm wearing the outfit. There's a lot to do with facial expressions and silence and nuance and me reacting to what the audience is saying and doing. And right before I'm supposed to go on stage, because it's a showcase of different comedians, the power goes out, the fuse blows just in the outlet that's powering the microphone and the spotlight for our area of the nightclub. So the spotlight on me goes out, so they rush to the stage with candles that they're putting at my feet, just so that they can see my feet, apparently. So candles at my feet, you can't see my face very well. And then the microphone doesn't work. And most stand-up comedians, I'm sure you know, tend to shout their set. So they don't really need a microphone anyway.
Right.
My Sung-hee Park character is very nervous and tentative, so I don't shout my material. And if I were to shout my material, it would betray the character that I'm playing.
Okay.
So now I am not able to be heard or seen, and I ended up turning a 20-minute set into about 5 minutes of excruciation where nobody laughed, and I walked off the stage, and people were completely confused. I mean, mortifying.
Well, because the only thing more difficult than doing stand-up comedy in a bar where you're wrapped in a curtain is doing performance art, which is basically what it became with the candles.
Doing performance art with just candles where people could see my feet, and they couldn't see my face, and they couldn't hear me.
Did you get any of this afterwards for the applause?
any beatnik?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Any beatnik
nothing,
stuff?
Nothing, huh? But, of course, I was approached by the foot fetish guys. They were like, great feet.
Yeah. Well,
that's
one day,
all start.
When we have more time, we don't have more time, but one day I'll tell you about going out to do a one-person show and finding out 5 minutes before I went out on stage. It's like, all right, Paul, it's going to be a great show. You're going to have a great time. The house is packed. It's going to be great. Oh, one more thing. It's a benefit for victims of traumatic brain injury. Okay, so I'll see you at intermission.
What?
Yes. Yes. True story. True story.
Wow. Tim, you've got to have one. Give us one. Here.
Well, you know, I had directed a show called Passion by Stephen Sondheim.
Yes.
And one of our actors was filming something, and he was not able to get out on time. And so at about 6 o'clock...
A common problem out here.
Yes. Yeah. So at about 6 o'clock, they're saying, well, do we cancel the show or do we go on? And so I said, well, you know, it's the role of the doctor. You know, maybe I can go on in costume. And think about it, I looked like Colonel Sanders when I went on as the doctor in Passion, because it's like 1800s Italy. And I had written all my lines everywhere, all over the set, wherever I was walking, so that it didn't look like I was carrying
Marlon Brando does that too. And how did it go?
It went well, but you know, I did not take into consideration that the lighting is very dark in the film. And I could not see a lot of the things that I wrote in the dark. And so I kind of like had to make it up.
So people are wondering why you're crouching really close to a desk before you say your line.
You know, and so I was trying to find the
Colonel Sanders is blind as a bat. Good thing he's got that chicken money.
But that's the actor's nightmare.
Well, thank you both. It was a delight having you on our unintentionally Asian-themed show.
Absolutely.
It was great. And I want to come to Mysterious Skin. Do I get an Asian discount?
Yes. That's
and come awesome. To Of Grapes and Nuts, too.
Oh, yes, I would love to do that.
You should work to his theater.
I know. I never have even tried out. We need to change that.
Yeah.
I should completely audition for that.
Absolutely.
And by the way, Michael, you're not a performer. Your voice is so good. Radio DJ, velvety voice.
Oh, hey, thank you. I used to perform, though.
Oh, okay.
Sing and act.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm Chopped Liver.
No, you're a performer already. I think of him as Mr. PR extraordinaire.
Okay, Michael, tell him who we got next week, because we got to wrap it up.
We have a good friend, Michael Orland, associate musical director from American Idol, who, along with his colleagues, has just completed Idol's nationwide search for its 2011 season competitors.
Thank you both. This has been State of the Arts. We're delighted to have both of our guests and this show. If you're listening to it live, you'll be able to hear it archived tomorrow, and we are also on iTunes now, which we're very excited about. Thank you for joining us here. Thank you all. Have a good week.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.